Hi, we're Visible, the wireless company with nothing to hide. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not into you. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Co-Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within art, beats, and lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Hello, and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer, here with my co-host, Max Linsky, and my co-host slash guest, Evan Ratliff. That's right. It's another meta episode of the Longform Podcast in which hosts interview each other.
We like to throw people for a loop in that way. They never know which host is hosting or which host might be a guest.
I can't think of any other times where the show has been even a little bit meta.
It's interesting because we actually have a kind of an abundance of episodes right now. You'd think this would be happening when we were really desperate that we would just suggest interviewing each other. But actually, I chose Evan out of many episodes we could have released this week. And it was a great decision because I got to listen to his new podcast, Persona, available in podcast apps everywhere. We are about to talk about it in this interview. Mild spoiler alert. I give it like, what would you give it? Like a 4 out of 10 on the spoiler scale, Evan?
Yeah, I think so. That sounds about right. A little bit of spoiler.
Okay. Well, so if you want to listen before the interview, go for it. If not, you'll probably be fine.
There was a good reason to put it out this week, though, which is that episode 8 of Persona came out on Monday. And episode 8, I'll just say, I have no bias on this at all. Fucking great podcast episode.
We've got the executive producer of the podcast in here also, Max Linsky.
We produce this show with our friends at Vox, thanks to them. And now here's Aaron interviewing Evan.
Welcome to the Longform Podcast. Evan interviewed me about my podcast, Exit Scam. And I'm now here to interview him about his newly released podcast, Persona. Welcome, Evan Ratliff.
It's great to be here, Aaron. It's especially great to be here because I love these where you have to do all the work. I don't have to do anything. I just have to answer your questions.
The show, as we say this, I think 6 or 7 out of the 8 episodes are out. I've now listened to the whole thing. By the time this is out, like, we'll be close to the whole thing being out. But this just went down like a nice cold glass of water. I was commuting into the city. I was listening to it. Went for a really nice walk. Listened to the last couple episodes. This has nothing to do with this interview. I just want to tell you what a great time I had listening to your podcast.
Well, I appreciate that. That's good. Good to know. If it was torture, 8 hours of torture, almost 8 hours. I guess they're 40 minutes or something. That wouldn't be great.
All right. So I'm going to try not to spoiler this too much of the second half of the show because there are some twists in there, but apologies in advance if we do spoiler any of it. But you have the basic premise of the show, which I would describe as kind of encapsulated in the first episode, which is this notorious scam that took place in France, heavily covered by the media. There's a French movie about it. And kind of my impression when I started listening to the show was, oh, Persona is a show about this scam and the guy behind it, which is true, but there are several other layers that come into play beyond that initial scam as the show goes on. How do you think about like how many layers you need to fill out one of these shows? It doesn't feel like it would have worked if it was just the original scam. It feels like it needs that kind of twist level to work.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, partly because I've done a lot of scam stories. So if you either write or produce or on the other end consume scam stories, you kind of discover that they all start to sound the same in certain ways. And it can just make them boring, you know? It's like the idea that people can be deceived and that they could be talked out of their money is like, it's an ancient idea, and it's one where the scams get replicated. Like the same elements are introduced over and over again in the scams. And so for me, that kind of like raises the bar on what kind of scam story I actually want to ever do, especially if it's going to be like 8 episodes of a podcast. So yeah, I mean, there were more kind of strands and themes than ended up in there in the end. But the big ones were going to be like, is this guy interesting enough? Like, can we establish that he kind of pioneered something that feels different and that had some like larger life to it that extended beyond him that we could get into? And then part of it was like, was there something within the scam, the elements of the scam, the targets, the victims, and him that felt like we could pull some hopefully new and different themes out of them? And like, we spent a long time like prototyping a, you know, pilot episode, and I had been following this for years and years and years and years. So we had like a pretty good idea that stuff was in there. And then we set out to do it, and then we had to like find the reporting that would prop it all up.
So tell me about when you became aware of the character in the show, Gilbert Sheekley, and how like what you had of this story evolved over time.
I first read about this scam in 2005, and I had this like French newspaper story from Libération. I have it right. It's in the folder right next to my desk right now. It's like this old printout that I printed off the web. And it has that like old web design, you know, like it wasn't really well designed for the web. And I was obsessed with Gilbert C. They didn't even print his last name at the time because he wasn't formally accused, because it had just happened. But it was basically like a guy had called up this bank manager, and he had convinced her first that he was the CEO of the bank or the head of the bank, and then said that they were doing a secret project to stop terrorist money laundering. And then she was going to hear from a secret agent. He then called back as the secret agent and then convinced her to take 360,000 euros out of the bank in cash and then hand it to someone in a bathroom stall in a cafe in downtown Paris. And this woman did this, then discovered it was a scam when the money was supposed to be returned to her with marked bills so that they could catch the terrorists. Of course, the money never came back. She went to the police, and then he started pulling off the scam over and over. So I had seen this one article, and it was just like the idea of this woman passing a bag of over 300,000 euros in cash in a bathroom. That detail was basically like, I thought about it all the time. Like once a year, I'd just be like, what's going on with Gilbert Sheekley? And from a kind of like freelance reporter trying to sell stories, I just never really found a place where I could do it. I didn't even pitch it. I would just be like, there's not enough there. Or at the beginning, no one will send me to go investigate this because he was in Israel. The crimes took place in France. It was like a big project. And then he became so famous that I was like, oh, everyone knows about this. No one's going to take this story because they're making a movie about him in France. And then there was like another round of scams that started. And then again, this is spoiler for some of the stuff that happens later in the show, but he gets arrested. And then when he got arrested the second time, I was kind of like, I think it could be done. Like, I think I could go do it now because I feel like the full story of his history is actually much richer than if I had done it at any point along the way. And then when he was prosecuted, that's when I started working on the story, actually like trying to report it.
Yeah, there's a funny quality of either you jump the gun and there isn't enough there and you're also competing with a lot of people, or you wait, which is kind of a form of gambling. You gambled that this story would have more if you, you know, put it in the hopper for 17 years after that initial encounter.
Yeah. Yeah, and I never want to take something on unless I feel like I can really get into it and find out something new that other people haven't found out, or at least get to people that haven't talked or come with a new approach. Like, the worst thing for me is to be doing a story where it's appearing a bunch of other places and it's just different versions of the same thing with mostly the same people talking. And you're right. I mean, these days, especially if you do like international crime, scams, organized crime. And for my book, I've had, I don't know, 10 different documentary filmmaker, director, producer types who are like, I'm working on a thing about Paul LaRue, which my book was about. And I'm working with Netflix, you know, they're all working with Netflix. And I don't think Netflix even knows that they're all out there saying, like, maybe they did one thing that they were associated with that appeared on Netflix. It's just like, there's like a swarm of people around certain types of stories. And I mean, most of the time I'll just walk away if I encounter that when I start reporting, because I just don't want to deal with like people who are there potentially paying sources. You know, also they're telling them they're going to be famous. They're telling them to be on TV. Like, it's a terrible situation. But then there are also these ones that just kind of slip under the radar because everyone already thinks that they've been done. And Shickley was a good example of that. Because there was a French movie about him, I think he was sort of famous enough in Israel and France that he seemed a little like done, but actually had this entire second act that was way more interesting in his life that was not covered because it felt like, oh, we know about him. We know what he's done. So I like stories like that where everyone forgets about it. And then I can go in and there's no one else there.
In the meantime, between you hearing about the story and bringing it to fruition 17 years later, you've done a series of stories. The main one that comes to my mind is the Hush Puppy story that focus on these emergent forms of fraud and crime that target large businesses for money transfers. So it does seem like some of that work that you've done in sort of understanding how these schemes work applies to multiple of these stories that you've done.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the phenomenon that I've been interested in for the last couple of years. And it's basically like the Hush Puppy story and this story. I mean, people will say like it's the golden age of scamming. And I think there's different elements of that. And one of them is like the calls that you get all the time of, you know, people trying to scam you individually. But the real money is in running these huge email and CEO impersonation scams where they get like $30, $40, $50 million at a time from a company by persuading them that they are the CEO of the company and they need an urgent transfer because they're making an acquisition, or just getting inside their email. That's the Hush Puppy story was, you know, his gang or the network he was associated with, they were just infiltrating people's email, forging invoices and getting tens of millions of dollars at a time. And to me, that's like a phenomenon that we haven't really grappled with entirely. Like, there's always been scammers, but you're talking about someone on one side of the world just sitting at a computer and taking $30 million out of like a large public company in the United States. That notion is completely insane. And I feel like I've been trying to find ways into that that make for interesting stories to tell that will convey that, because the scams themselves can be like rote or boring just in their details. Shickley, I think, is different.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari, W, and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Calling all female runners, it's time to lace up and join Team Milk. Since the 2022 New York City Marathon, Team Milk has sponsored female marathon runners nationwide, providing support and shining a spotlight on their unique stories, perseverance, and drive to go the distance. Why milk? Dairy milk is an excellent nutritional add for both marathon training and recovery. Milk contains 13 essential nutrients, including high-quality protein, making it a crucial component of a training diet. Plus, it's one of the best beverages for hydration, even better than water. The same electrolytes that are added to many of your favorite sports drinks are found naturally in milk. And in 2024, Team Milk is taking the next step to empower female runners by launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. Built to be accessible, empowering, and community-building, the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia, on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
When you started on Chick-fil-A, it seems like it wasn't particularly well known who his co-conspirators were. There was co-conspirators for the first wave of crimes, one of whom I believe went to prison. And then, well, I won't spoiler alert what happened to him, but you find out what happened to him in the show. But fast forwarding to now, who he was working with now, if he was doing anything at all, was kind of unknown. So when you picked this up and you started needing to like find people who'd actually interacted with Chick-fil-A, who'd actually done these scams, where did you start?
Well, we started where I usually start, which is like with the court documents. So the French court documents are generally less extensive than what you would find in the States. And so you can't get all of the filings the way you would get here, but you can get a pretty extensive, at least summary of sort of what all the evidence was in the case. And then, you know, we start trying to find those people. Oftentimes you're going through the lawyers for those people and trying to figure out where they are. Are they in prison? Are they out of prison? And then we got really, really lucky in one way. I mean, on the one hand, like we got lucky. On the other hand, it was just good reporting on the part of this reporter, Chris Knapp, who we were working with in Paris. He was a producer on the show and he was doing a lot of stuff from Paris. And someone gave him the police file on the case. When I say full police file, I mean 25,000 pages of every piece of evidence that the police obtained in trying to track this particular case. The funny thing is, we don't even talk about it in the show that much, but like we got it for his earlier one too, the earlier scam. So there's two sets of scams. There's a 2005 one and a 2015 one. And that one's even bigger. It's like 30,000 pages or something. And this was like reporting goldmine. If you listen to the show, it's like a character in the show. You know, it's like so crucial to how we both find the people because they're all in there, but also how we fill in all the gaps that normally you can't fill in because you only know what the police present through the prosecutors in court, which is like their best version of what they have. And then when you see everything they have, then you start seeing both what they missed, what they fucked up, who they had, who they never went after, and also what they really had on the people involved. And so once we had that, we kind of shifted from the normal, let's go through the lawyers and try to find the people, to like, oh, let's use this as our starting point, and we will use this to find as many people as we can who are involved. Now, of course, that's also like a volume game where you're basically like contacting all these people, most of whom will never talk to you, some of whom will yell at you, and then trying to find the one or two who will actually, like, for whatever reason, decide that they want to talk.
And I should say that there's an additional degree of difficulty here because that's all in French, maybe with a little Hebrew mixed in. How did you deal with that? Do you speak French?
No, I would say I don't speak French. I can speak a little French, but I'm terrified to speak French. I took French in like junior high and high school, 6 years of French, but sadly only certain elements were retained. So I can read it because you just have a lot more time to just sit with it. So I can read things and get the very basic gist. And then it turned out that when we did interviews, because they were very domain specific, I could ask someone a question in English, and they often understood the questions in English. And if they spoke back to me in French, I could understand what they were saying, because it was like, I kind of knew what the boundaries were of what they were going to say. So my brain would sort of fill in the words that I didn't know. So that worked. But if you dropped me into, like, as I was in Paris, like in a French cafe, and I'm like overhearing someone, I'm clueless. Like, I'm not good at understanding sort of like pure French. So that was a huge challenge. That was part of the reason why I didn't do the story for a long time. But then it was kind of like, I don't know. Then it was in, there was Hebrew, there was Turkish, there was Polish, there was like Ukrainian documents. So after a while, like, the fact that there was more languages made me feel less embarrassed that I wasn't like fluent in the main language, because we were going to have to use a bunch of translators anyway. So we had incredible translators and reporters who worked with us, including Chris Knapp, who I mentioned, who's in Paris.
When you're interviewing a French subject, are you like sitting next to a producer who speaks French? How do you conduct an interview?
Well, we did it all sorts of different ways. So we had, sometimes we did Zoom interviews in which there would be in one box a translator, and in one box me, and in one box the subject, and then in one box like one of our producers from Pineapple, like Henry Malofsky, would be maybe there listening as well. And then sometimes we tried to get them to speak English. So if they spoke a little bit of English, it was this question of like, would you rather their like somewhat broken English be in the show, or would you rather have like a pure statement of their story in French, and then we'll translate it later? And then in person, we would sometimes have a translator, but then I kept making, I think, what was a mistake, and rightfully identified by the extremely talented producers as a mistake, that I could understand a lot of what they were saying. So I would just ignore the translator and I would just continue. So like, they would answer in French and I would say, ah, yeah, I understand what you're saying. Like, here's my next question based on that. But then we had no live translation on tape. Like, on tape, it was me speaking English and them speaking French. And so they would have to be voiced over by like an actor with wonderful French accents and voices to like do the voices. So some of the things were voiced over, some of the things like I translated in the show, but it was actually like a very complicated question. And it kind of like came up every time, like, how are we going to do this one? And eventually, like, the producer said to me, like, can you just let the translator translate? Even if you understand, like, please, we understand that you are proud that you know a little bit of French, but like, could you please just like let the translator translate it so that we will have that for the tape? And even after they told me, sometimes I wouldn't do it. Like, I was so into the fact that I could understand French that I was like not doing the best thing for the show. But the shorter answer is, like, we tried all sorts of things, and you can hear them in the show. Like, it's done different ways with different people, depending how long they're in there. If it's a long segment with them, or it's just like one quote, basically.
What did you feel like you needed to get this show to work? And tell me about some of the like low points where you weren't sure you were going to be able to get it.
I could talk a lot about the low points. I mean, this is a phenomenon I think that's happening a lot where, I mean, of course, like, you and I have done a podcast for 10 years. So I am a podcaster, but I've not done narrative audio. And so it's a different animal. I've written many magazine stories and books, whatever else. And the differences, like, they come to light when you start writing the scripts. You know, like, you can go out and do the reporting, but when you write the scripts, you realize, oh, there are certain things that I can write my way out of in a normal story that I cannot write my way out of here. Like, if the tape isn't there, it can't just be straight narration. Now, one of the low points was just like when we couldn't get reporting that I thought we were going to get. Like, there were all kinds of things that I thought, if you made a list of 20 ideal reporting moments that I wanted, and I was like, if we get 5 of these, we're gold. And it was like, one guy died right before we're going to interview him. We had definitely identified him as our best possible source. We'd been talking to him for months. He was like, I'm going to tell you everything. I'm going to tell you the story that's not been told. He's like, your dream. The stuff he's saying is a dream. And then, but he wanted to do it in person. And then we tried to meet up with him and it didn't work out. And then we we should have just forced him to do a Zoom. You know, we should have just gotten that. But instead, we were like, okay, we're coming to Israel. He's going to be in Israel. And then he died within like 12 hours before we were supposed to interview him. And I mean, that was absolutely a low point because it was a, just a sad life moment. But then also we felt like we were fucked, you know, like we had lost our best source. And then you kind of like feel guilty for feeling bad. It's like self, you know, it's a selfish feeling to say like this person died, his family and friends are bereft, and like our show is screwed. You know, that's like terrible. That's a terrible feeling to have on top of it all. So it's trying to like orient yourself around all of that. And so then, you know, we didn't have anyone else die, but we had a bunch of moments like that where we sort of thought something was going to come through and then it just didn't, or someone had tapes and we were like, we're going to get these tapes. And then they disappeared, or that turned out they didn't have the tapes at all. And that became very like, I became very upset about that over time. Like, we're just not getting the stuff that we need, and very afraid that we would run into this problem that I would have to just like narrate the whole thing. But as it turned out, like, we had gotten more than I thought, I think, along the way. Like, when we actually sat down and looked at it, and the producers, like, again, Henry Malofsky, Sophie Bridges at Pineapple, like, they know what they're like incredibly talented at this. So I think they were a little more aware of like, we've got good stuff. Then I'm just paranoid about never having enough reporting. And then we also had this police file, but the police file, it's not audio. Like, so we had to find ways to like animate that, to like pull that into narrative while also using the tape that we have around it. So it wouldn't just be me like talking, but there are like, for me, surprisingly long segments of me just talking in the show.
Yeah. And then on the flip side, there's audio of things that I would have never possibly thought there was going to be audio of. Like, there's audio of like the Aga Khan getting scammed, you know, and it's very obviously real audio that's in no way like staged or recreated. It's like the sound of an old man getting scammed. Wait, how did you get, are you comfortable saying how you got that?
I can't say who it came from, but I mean, basically these incredibly wealthy people were scammed, two in particular, the Aga Khan, in France, and Inan Kuraç, who's like one of the wealthiest people in Turkey. And so they were both scammed in for tremendous amounts of money, a total of like $70 million. And there were tapes. Once they figured out what was going on, in but one case, the police made tapes, and the other case, the Inan Kuraç himself or his people made tapes. So these, we knew these tapes existed because they were the primary thing that was used in court. So they were played out loud in court, but no one was allowed to record anything in court. So we knew a lot of people had copies of these tapes. So it was basically a many months process of mostly Chris, our reporter in Paris, like trying to figure out who to ask. When we went to Paris, we would ask everybody, you know, like, do you have the tapes? Like, hey, what about the tapes? You know, turn off the recorder and be like, one more thing. What about the tapes? And they're like, oh, I think this person has the tapes, or, oh, I think they're in my storage facility. And it was just like endless grasping at this thing that we knew like that would make the show. Like, if we had those tapes, that would make the show. And then like we got them, and it was, I mean, it was pretty great for, as a reporting moment, that and like the police file were some of the best reporting moments I've had in my career, I would say.
This week on The Pitch, it's tween time.
We're redefining feminine hygiene for tweens.
You've done 5 million in sales. You did 3 million last year. Very impressive.
Thank you.
I really believe in this category. I'm an investor in a company called AmpFloat.
And similarly, I'm a personal investor in Ruby Love.
Like Elizabeth and Charles, I have seen a lot of these companies. Mm-hmm. I've never made an investment in the space. You should be raising more than $500,000.
As a Black woman, for me to come on here and say, I'm going to become the new Always, that's super audacious. And I could we,
Always.
For sure.
What makes it audacious?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it.
You told us what you wanted. That's what I wanted to hear.
I get the sense back her experience might have been a little different.
Save the mic.
That looked really expensive.
This week on The Pitch, Monica Williams drops the mic. Go right now and subscribe to The Pitch, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prop G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Kara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from Blue Flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. Not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
There's a piece of the tone of Persona, and I'm not singling Persona out because I think this is almost standard fare for narrative podcasts, where you kind of break the fourth wall and you're like, I'm going to tell you a story about this. We're going to do this, and it's going to like tell you about this scammers, which are a modern phenomenon that means this. And I think it like struck me because I know you so well that I was like, a moment like this would never be in one of Evan Ratliff's magazine stories. And I'm curious, like, as someone who's got a long, long history doing print work, what it was like adapting to that kind of writing and how you thought about those ingredients in the storytelling.
It was, it's definitely tricky to adapt. Like, a lot of the go-to moves in a magazine story for me didn't really work in this environment and had to be shed. And then you're absolutely right. Like, I mean, in a magazine story, I would call that a nut graph. And I'm like extremely resistant to nut graph or billboard graphs in magazine stories. Like the paragraph that says like, I'm going to tell you what this story is about. You know, it's like an introduction in a book. To me, like an introduction in a book is not, that's not something that I want to find in a narrative book. I just want to get into the story and read the story and learn what I'm going to learn and be pulled along in an entertaining and surprising way with some, you know, narrative tension. Like, that's how I want it to work. I don't want someone to say like, this book is going to be about X, Y, and Z. You know, that's a different kind of informational book or informational magazine story. However, and this is a discussion that I had many, many times with Joel Lovell, who is the editor of the show, who has also been on the Long Form podcast way back when he was a magazine editor, that audio, you just, because of the way people consume it, you need different markers. Like, you need different frames. You need to set people up in different ways for what they're going to hear and orient them in it so that they will stay with it. And I was resistant to it. And we had a lot of back and forth about what it would be and where it would live. And, you know, we landed on what I think is a good version of it. But the funny thing is, like, it's all new to me. Like, I hadn't done it before. So I don't really have except having listened to a bunch of podcasts, which I love. I love narrative podcasts. Like, I don't really have any standing to tell people who've been working in audio a long time how it should go. So, like, that's a tension also. It's like, I feel like I know what I'm doing when it comes to writing and reporting, but also clearly I don't have the expertise to like know exactly how this story should be told. So that was like the push and pull of editing, which was both Joel and the producers who also know how audio should be shaped. So it's like all of us trying to figure out where that stuff goes.
What I think is interesting about that kind of billboarding early on is that in this context, a story that does have a twist in it, you're actually not billboarding where this story is going. There's almost like a scammery switch in the narrative, but the way that you've structured the story, you don't say, and we're going to see if he was wrongly convicted 15 years later of this other crime. That part is hidden, and we don't sort of know. Like, I was thinking about episode three, I was like, wow, I wonder what Evan is going to fill five more episodes here with. And that is not billboarded. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, this is making me very happy because we haven't talked about this before, but like that to me is the actual underlying theme of the show, which is that one of these kinds of big scams or cons is like a story. And in the story, what they're doing is they're manipulating you to be a participant in the story. And they're getting you so hooked that you will not just do anything they say, but you will invest yourself in bringing the story to its conclusion. And like, isn't that what you're doing? If you're trying to get someone to listen to eight episodes, spend that much of their life listening to your voice, talking about things, like I viewed it as this interesting, like parallel. It's not really a scam. And I feel like the other folks that worked on the show didn't like it when I described it as like, aren't we doing a scam too? Because it's not a scam. But it's like, ultimately, we're doing that both for journalistic reasons, but also so that like the show can exist and like they sell ads against it and it's a commercial endeavor at some level. Like, I really think that parallel is fascinating. I think the idea that we also, that every story has this person pulling the strings and they can manipulate you in all sorts of ways, whether they're still telling a true story or not, to me, I find that very interesting. And I feel like I like revisiting that in everything that I do. And here it was just like, it felt like we could really weave it into the show itself.
Was it difficult, like after taking on this initial challenge of telling the first story, then you have sort of another set of crimes that potentially were done by a different person who's introduced pretty late, like almost the second half of this podcast almost could be a second season of the podcast in which the stakes are dramatically changed. How deep did you feel like you had to get into those crimes and that additional suspect to feel like you had done this sort of secondary story?
Very deep. I mean, I felt like it was tricky, and I really hope it works for people. Like, not that many people have heard the full thing yet. So like, I don't actually know if it works for a lot of people yet or not. But there were these two sets of scams which were similar, but the second one built on the first one, and they were 10 years apart. And so it was like, we kept having this question, can we pull people into one and then exit it and then pull them into a whole another one? And the hope is that there's enough new and different in the second one that you start to see like, oh, wait, there's something bigger and different going on here. And then also the idea that there might be other people behind it is kind of like, we have the police story, and the police story is that this guy's the mastermind and we're going to catch him. Like, we know from the beginning that it's this guy because he did it before. And so you're kind of like, you get caught up in that too, you know, as a listener, you're like caught up in that. And if someone were to listen really carefully, like, I never say he did it. It's just like, this is what the police are saying along the way. So it seems very much like maybe we're saying that he did it, and, you know, the court might be saying he did it. But then we wanted to kind of like unwind that in the last episode.
It would almost be wrong to not mention, like, you couldn't really talk about Shikle without mentioning that he is, I believe, currently in jail for this crime, and that there's significant evidence he did not commit that crime, and that police actually thought someone else committed that crime, or at least was a co-conspirator in that crime.
Yeah. And it's also like, for me, the courtroom aspect of it is, it's not like it's not like an Innocence Project type case in the U.S. where it's like, is this person on death row, you know, improperly on death row. But I mean, you got a guy who is like an admitted scammer. Like, he's bragged about being one of the world's great scammers, who's convicted in a scam. He's going to be in prison for another up to 10 years probably for it. But like, if you look at the evidence, it's not even a question of like there being like clearly exonerating evidence for him. It's like, is there enough evidence to convict this person? Or was this person convicted on the reputation that he himself created about himself? So he basically built himself up as a genius and trapped himself in that persona. That's why this. That's why it's called. That's why the whole thing's called persona. And then they used it against him, you know. And so, are there ways to take a normal like courtroom type drama and kind of change it and make it feel different to people and find some themes in there that are not the themes that you encounter in every story? So that was kind of what we hoped we found with him, was like, oh, actually, the closer you look at this, the stranger and more complicated it actually gets.
So now, having one of these under your belt, what do you feel like works in this format that was surprising, or like, oh, wow, that really came together? And what of the stuff, you know, from your experience of doing many, many other print stories, do you feel like doesn't work in a story like this?
There's lots of things. Like in a normal magazine story, you just like quote someone, you know, you could quote someone just a single quote, two sentences, you introduce them in the middle, you say, blah, 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 says this person, an expert on this from this university, and then they're gone. But you just like, that just doesn't work. Like everybody has to be a character that you like pull on stage, and you try to find ways to like lodge them in the memory of the listener. And that's something that like the producers and Joel, the editor, like they would just remind me over and over, is like, you got to find ways. And the people who are amazing at this, who have done lots of the best narrative audio, like a Brian Reed or Dan Taberski or, you know, Zoe Chase or people like that, like they know, it seems like instinctively now, probably how to do this, how to like lodge someone in the listener's memory, because especially over 8 episodes, you're just like, who's that person again? Like, and they're not going to remember the names and they can't look back. So when it happens naturally, you're like, oh, that's the thing. That's the thing I should have been doing with everyone. Like I had this one, my favorite moment, it's not a reporting moment, but like my favorite moment like that in the whole show is like, this guy, this Israeli guy, he's a lawyer for Gilbert Shikli. And he says, you know, Gilbert, he's like a cat. Like he has 7 lives. And I was like, what? You say 7? Like we say 9. And he was like, no, we say 7 here. And I just like, just trying to make conversation, I just said, oh yeah, that makes more sense. Which it doesn't. Like nothing makes 7, 9 doesn't make sense. It's just an expression. And that was like, I was so excited to put that in the show. But there were, what I didn't do, because part of it is like performance, you know, like it's not intentional performance, but sitting down with the mics on and just having like some chit chat, like fun chit chat, where you like ease into the interview, you don't just start asking questions. And I would do that in a reported interview, but we wouldn't tape it, you know, and like trying to get that so that you get a few things that give someone like just a little bit of human flavor for people to like actually consume and like hold on to.
Like people do that naturally all the time. All the time you meet someone and you have like a funny little like moment with them, but trying to be like, okay, like dock it, meet, have funny moment, get into actual interview. It doesn't go that way unless you're like subtly guiding it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's also why like some of the like, this type of material came at the end of the interviews for us, because also if you sit down, you can be chit-chatting and having like a really nice conversation, and then someone sits down in front of a microphone and they just change, you know, they just completely change. And that's not, when you're doing print reporting, it's not a problem because you're just holding a little recorder and they'd forget about it almost instantly, or it might be on the table or something. And so, but it's when they sit in front of a microphone, a lot of people take on a certain stiffness and formality that then it takes longer to work through. So, I mean, this is all stuff that like, I hope no audio producers are listening. They're like, eyes are like rolling into the back of their heads with like, yes, thank you for illuminating this topic. But I think it is like, it's useful to talk about because there are a lot of people who have not been doing audio who for reasons of like buzz and money, are getting into narrative podcasting now. Like a lot of magazine type reporters and narrative reporters are doing this stuff because it's kind of like where the action is. And it's not as easy as just like dropping in and like sitting in front of a microphone and reciting your reporting. You know, it's like, it's actually very, very hard.
So as you go forward, How would you evaluate like what a good story to do as a podcast miniseries is versus a print story versus just some story? Like what would you be looking for if you were going to do another one of these?
I think, well, first I'll say, fortunately, like someone else would always decide, like you got to pitch it to someone and they have to say, so they'll hopefully ask you all the questions that you need to have answered. But like the number one thing is, you know, can you get any of these people on tape? Like that would be the first thing I would ask. Or is there some sort of like existing audio that you're going to take advantage of and make the center of it? So it can be the greatest story in the world, but like if you can't get people on tape, obviously it's not going to work for audio. But then I think the next question is like a lot of these shows, including mine, like 8 episodes is that's a like seems to be like an industry approach to a lot of these kind of shows. I mean, which is funny because I feel like some of the very, very best, like S-Town is the very, very best of this stuff. And it, I think it was only 6, you know? So like, I don't know why it has to be 8, but for commercial reasons, perhaps 8. And for something to go over 8, 30, 40 minute, even up to an hour episodes, like it's a lot. Each one of the scripts is like 8,000 words, you know? That's a long magazine story. So you've got 8,000 word magazine stories. Like the kind of story that you need to sustain over that for me is quite hard to find. Like it's like finding a book because you know the shows that don't have that and you're in episode, you know, 5 and it's kind of like now we're going to talk about to totally different people about a different story and then it just, you know, they're just not enough. Like you can tell they're just filling in. And so that's the thing I'd be most paranoid about is like finding a story that sustains that much narrative, that much surprise in it, that even by episode 8, people will be like, I really want to find out what happens.
Yeah, I would agree with you that 6 is optimized and 8 is like, no one's really going to notice if we tack a couple episodes on the end of this here. Like I was actually wondering in the episode where you go into all of the copycat, I was like, is this going to come back and matter at all? Because like, I'm not sure I care. And then it's like, oh, yes. No, it actually does matter a lot. But could see how you can start going off on some side streets that are interesting, but do not like re-merge with the main artery here.
Yeah. And I was very afraid of that. Like, even we did one episode it's connected, but it's a thin connection when it comes to like directly having to do with the character at the center of it. I mean, it is connected to him, but pulling people into that and I was afraid that people would listen to that and be like, oh, I see where this is going. Now the rest of the episode is just going to be about something. Each one will be about a different scam or whatnot. It'll just be totally different and trying to like make sure that people knew that we were going to come back to it. And that's one of the things that's kind of disappointing to me about the way that podcasts get written about, which is like they're written up by people who have consumed like the first 4 episodes, which I guess is probably how like prestige TV is often covered too. But it's like, to me, it's like a book. Like it's the whole thing. It's like reading half a book and being like, well, I kind of recommend this book. And people have been very nice, so I'm not complaining about the reviews of it. But it's just like, by the time you get to the end, like everyone's already done their thing and like there might not be anyone left to like, I want someone to write like their full assessment of the whole book, not just like half the book, and be like, well, there's some unanswered questions, but you should listen to it.
Well, my assessment of the full book is that it was excellent. I highly recommend it. And thank you very much for this interview.
Aaron, I love talking to you on mic, off mic. I will return as a guest on the Long Form Podcast anytime you want.
Hey, that was the Long Form Podcast. Thanks very much for listening. Thanks to my guest and co-host, Evan Ratliff. Thanks to my other co-host, executive producer of the podcast discussed, Max Linsky. Thanks to Jackie Sajiko, who edited this episode. Thanks to our intern, Susan Peterson. Thanks to everyone over at Vox. We'll be back next week.
So
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cult Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.